Well, I want to invite you to reach for your handout as we look at these two stories that our lectionary brings to our attention. All through ordinary time, the lectionary is going to give us readings from what scholars call Luke's narrative of Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. A journey that he takes from Galilee, where he spends much of his ministry, and he begins to advance to Jerusalem, where we all know where the story leads, to betrayal, to scorn, to condemnation, and to death. He's beginning his journey here, and you see that beginning in verse 51. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. Now that phrase, set his face, is wonderful. It comes from Isaiah. It has to do with setting your face like flint. Have you ever heard that phrase before? It's a phrase of determination and of commitment. It is steel resolve that you have a purpose and you're setting your face toward a certain end. And you have to set your face because trials and challenges and difficulties lie ahead. And the only way to surmount those and to confront those is not to run from it, which is our temptation, but to set your face. And so Jesus is setting his face with fixed determination to head toward Jerusalem, where he knows what his fate has in store. All along the way for 10 chapters, Jesus is going to be teaching his disciples how to set their face too. He's going to be teaching his disciples how to have the same firm resolve and commitment to the kingdom of God as he has in these stories before us. So we have two separate stories, two interesting stories placed in juxtaposition here. The first story in the first paragraph has to do with Jesus preparing to visit a Samaritan village. He sends out an advanced team of James and John to prepare the way. And what's interesting is that they even go, because there was bad blood between Jews and Samaritans. Most of those of you who are familiar with the New Testament know that already. Jews and Samaritans did not get along. Jews considered Samaritans half-breeds. They weren't full-blooded Jews. And even worse, they considered Samaritans heretics, because the Samaritans refused to go to the Jerusalem temple to worship. They had built their own temple on Mount Gerizim that they had access to. And so they wanted nothing to do with the worship at the temple in Jerusalem. So for the Jews, the Samaritans were bad blood, they were heretics, they were people to be despised. The fact that Jesus convinces James and John to go visit them, and James and John actually does, shows the weight of his leadership. They're willing to go, and they're ready to do his mission until they face a bit of trouble. They're rejected by the Samaritans. The Samaritans want nothing to do with them or with Jesus. Look at verse 53. But they, the Samaritans, did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. You see, they have religious issues with Jesus. Jesus is going to Jerusalem, to the temple. They don't see that as valid. They have their own temple in Mount Gerizim. They want nothing to do with Jesus or his followers or his message of the kingdom of God. To which James and John, who are nicknamed the Sons of Thunder, nicknamed that for a reason, they were hotheads, they asked Jesus a question. I love this question. Verse 54, when the disciples James and John saw it, Lord, can we kill him? Can we kill him now? They deserve it, don't they? Can't we command fire from heaven and incinerate this village? They want nothing to do with you. They've rejected you. And by the way, Lord, there is a precedent for this. Remember Elijah? When the prophets of Baal resisted the prophet of God, Elijah called down fire from heaven and incinerated those heretics. We see this as a similar situation. So Jesus, can we burn them now? Can we destroy them? To which Jesus responds very simply in verse 55 with, but Jesus turned and rebuked them. Here's what's interesting. We are always tempted to use violence when we feel that it'll achieve the end that we desire. We think sometimes that insult entitles us to injury, and being right gives us the validity to justify the use of force or violence to make sure others get either behind our cause or out of the way of our cause. That same temptation was there for Jesus' disciples. They had the ability, they had the power, they had the authority, they're looking to use it. But Jesus in verse 55 doesn't rebuke the Samaritans. Jesus turns to James and John and says, hey guys, it's not the Samaritans that are the problem here. You're the problem. You've got the wrong spirit. You've got the wrong mind. And if you think the kingdom of God is going to be established by force or violence, you haven't heard a word I've said. You haven't understand the spirit of this ministry whatsoever. So he says to his disciples, you're the ones that are the problem. Because retaliation of any kind is not going to be an option for Jesus' followers. His kingdom won't be a triumphant march, sweeping all resistance aside on a search and destroy mission. Instead, his mission is a seek and save mission. And we know this because of the cross. Jesus will never take the path of violence to establish the kingdom. The kingdom will be established by humble, self-giving love. And so Jesus rebukes them, and then quite simply in verse 56, they went on to another village. Jesus isn't going to condemn the Samaritans. He's not going to curse them. He instead is going to move on as he's taught his disciples. If they reject you, wipe the dust from your feet and move to the next place, because we've set our face like flint. We've committed to a cause, and if they want nothing to do with it, that means we just take it to the next place. In doing this, Jesus is setting the pattern. Because when he faces the worst kind of inhospitality in Jerusalem, the scorning, the mocking, the betrayal, the death, he will not respond in retaliation. He will not respond with violence. He will respond in self-giving love. So our first story is all about walking in the way of Jesus is walking in the way of peace. But then there's more. And here's what I find interesting. I think this text challenges both conservatives and progressives because, you know, it challenges conservatives in the fact that violence will never be a means through which the kingdom of God is brought forward. And many progressives leap on that. Oh, yeah, that's right. No violence. But then progressives have trouble with the second paragraph that sometimes conservatives think they're just fine with. Because Jesus will not only say that the way of the kingdom is the way of peace, he'll also say the way of the kingdom is ultimate allegiance to Jesus. That it is total and utter and absolute loyalty of the highest sort to the kingdom, to the reign of God, to the mission of Jesus. And so he has this very interesting story in our second paragraph of three people that want to follow Jesus, and yet they all have conditions attached. They all have excuses, some more eager than others, but all of them having these certain kind of ways to put off full commitment to Jesus. And so look at these three individuals. The first one, verse 57, as they're going along the road, someone says to them with great eagerness, I will follow you wherever you go. To which Jesus says, do you realize what that means? Do you understand where I'm going? I can promise you no security. I have no place to lay my head. I can promise you no great mass of possessions because I don't have anything I possess. I'm reduced to being someone who's committed to others' hospitality. They either take me in or I sleep on the streets. I'm offering you nothing other than just following me. So if you think this is going to be a cakewalk, you shouldn't be going in my direction. And so Jesus kind of pushes him back and says in verse 58, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nest, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. In other words, Jesus says to him, do you realize what you're saying? Wherever I'll go, no matter what that means, really? And of course, that challenges us. Then you have a second person with the best excuse you could ever give. This excuse is so good, you ought to have taken offense at Jesus' response, because everyone in his vicinity would have been offended by his response. Verse 59, to another he said, follow me. And the poor man says, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. To which Jesus seemingly callously says, let the dead bury their own dead, but as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God. The reason why that was offensive in Jesus' time, and still to modern ears, is the highest obligation a Jewish son had was to honor his father in burial. That's how you keep the command, honor your mother and father. And so anyone listening to this would have been outraged by the callousness of Jesus saying, hey, that's not a good enough excuse. Set your face. Move forward. Now, before we reflect on that excuse, let's look at the third excuse again here. Don't take away the offensiveness of that, because that's intended to challenge at the deepest core of anything we think is valid. The third person, verse 61, another said, I'll follow you, but first let me say farewell to those at home. Let me take care of some family matters, to which Jesus says, hey, No one who puts the hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. Why? Well, we illustrated that with the children. If you are trying to move forward and you're constantly looking back, you're not going to plow a straight line. Your service is going to be ineffective. It has no focus. It has no determination. It is not setting your face. It is instead looking back instead of moving forward. Three people wanting to follow Jesus. Three with excuses, three with conditions. What's going on here? And what's going on here is very interesting, and it takes a little bit of tweaking out. What's obvious here, and we'll say it all the time, is Jesus is calling for the priority of the kingdom. Seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be given to you. He is calling us to have our highest allegiance and first loyalty, not to valuable things like culture, or tradition, or even family. He's inviting us to place our highest allegiance to Him as Lord and to the mission He's given us. Now, He's not undermining any of these other worthy responsibilities. There's a reason why all of these are worthy responsibilities. The necessity of home and the security of place, the sacred duty of bearing one's parent, relations with family. These are high priorities, and Jesus is using these highest priorities for reason. To show that there's even a higher priority. If He used lesser priorities, if He said, hey, if you want to follow me, you have to give up using NutraSweet, then it would trivialize what He's saying. If He said, if you want to follow me, you can't watch the Brady Bunch ever again, it would trivialize it. Unless Brady Bunch is your highest loyalty, and if so, God help you. You understand that if Jesus uses any lesser loyalties, He's going to actually trivialize what He's trying to say. That yes, we have high loyalties, but He's even calling for a higher allegiance. Fred Craddock, the great preacher, actually summarizes in one statement what Jesus is saying. The radicality of Jesus' words lies in His claim to priority over the best, not the worst, of human relationships. He uses the best to illustrate that if the best excuses against following Him won't fly, then no excuses will. Because these are good excuses, particularly burying your own father. That's a good excuse. That's the best excuse you could ever give. And Jesus is essentially saying even that excuse won't fly. Now, before we're too hard on Jesus and the allegiance He demands, understand that He's not asking for anything other than what we demand of certain people when we've asked them to set their face on something. Let me illustrate that for you. When we call people into military service, we demand that they train, that they leave family, that they leave friends, that they leave the comforts and conveniences of their home. And once they're in service, I know by talking to many relatives here of people in service, sometimes your family member can't say where they're at, they can't say where they're stationed, they can't say what they do. We accept that, no problem. Yeah, of course. That's the kind of commitment we're looking for. Well, Jesus is looking for the same. We ask the same of our athletes. We expect our Packers to spend 6 to 8 weeks in grueling training. They're not partying. They're not enjoying comforts. They're not enjoying conveniences. No contact with family and friends. Completely committed and setting their face to be the superior football team of the year. When our kids go away to college, I'm experiencing my second one leaving this fall. When our kids go to college, we expect that they're leaving family. They're leaving friends, particularly if they're going out of town. And they won't be coming home every day. They won't be asking us what to do every single moment because they're committed to something. They're setting their face on something. What I want you to see with these three examples is Jesus isn't asking for any more allegiance than we often ask from people that we know should set their face and be committed to something. What Jesus is simply doing is trumping even the best of commitments. He is essentially saying, you know, there's commitments to family, there's commitments to security, there's commitments to mother, father, and certain other loyalties. They're all valid. They're all worthwhile. But He's asking for an ultimate allegiance. If we ask for that kind of commitment for these things, how much more should we demand and expect Jesus would demand that kind of commitment for the kingdom, for the mission of God? For God, who trumps everything, who transcends it all. So that what I think is going on in this passage is wonderful in that Jesus is honest. He's doing truth in advertising. He's saying, you know, discipleship's costly. It's not cozy. It's not comfortable. It's hard. It's grueling and challenging. There will be competing claims for your allegiance. You'll have to reprioritize your commitments. You'll have to set your face. You'll have to be firmly, steely, resolved, because there'll be a lot of things to distract you and a lot of things, even good things, that will cause that straight line to become crooked. All this week, as I was thinking of this sermon and this passage, there's a song that kept coming to mind for me. I probably heard it when I was 6 years old, listening to AM radio in my car with my parents, and it was this song, and you'll see why this song stuck with me. I don't even know the title of it. I beg your pardon, I never promised you a rose garden. You remember that song? Some of you older folk do, younger folk probably don't. Chris, do you know that song? You're younger. I'm any younger. Gene? All right. Who's the youngest person that knows that song? Okay. I would imagine it's had its day on radio. I beg your pardon. I never promised you Rose Garden. That's what Jesus is doing here. He's being sincere. He's doing truth in advertising. We're used to advertising that covers over things, that doesn't tell us the whole story. We're used to a lot of things that really hide a lot behind what they're asking of us. Jesus is too truthful to hide anything. He makes it very clear that those who follow him should be under no illusions of what it will mean for them. He's not promising a rose garden. And he will not tolerate any conditions or excuses. He just won't allow that. He understands it's a high call, it's a high commitment, but he's calling us to a vocation, not a vacation. As we follow on the way to Jerusalem, it's not there for our convenience and enjoyment. He understands there's a lot of challenges ahead, and therefore he invites his disciples to have the same mindset he does, to set their face like flint. Because following Jesus is not a hobby. It's not a part-time or momentary commitment. To serve the God of the cosmos is the highest allegiance, the highest priority that anyone can possibly fathom. And if that doesn't have some kind of life-changing shift in our direction and priorities, perhaps we're not really following. Perhaps we'd like to think we are, but what we have is Jesus in our back pocket, who's a nice hobby and occasionally makes our life a little easier, instead of the Jesus that says, set your face. I want your highest loyalty, your highest commitment. I want you to serve as I'm serving and to live as I'm living. Well, that's a high call. It challenges us all. If it doesn't challenge you, you're not listening to him. You're writing Jesus off and you're creating, you know, the hippie Jesus of your fantasies. This is the Jesus who is in the Gospels, the truth teller, the honest one, the one who at least is honest enough to tell us what he expects of us and yet is gracious enough to put up with us as we bumble and stumble all along the way. Because think of it. He's putting up with James and John, the sons of thunder. I mean, he's tolerating these hotheads who have so little clue of what his kingdom is about, they're ready to snuff out people in an instant. And he's tolerating them. And then he's challenging them. Be committed. Understand, set your face. We're heading to Jerusalem, following Jesus on the way of peace, the way of commitment and priorities. What's beautiful about that second paragraph as we draw to a close is we don't know how any of these three responded. Did you notice that? We're never told that they decide, oh yeah, you're right, Jesus, I'll follow you. We never hear if the guy says, hey, let the dead bury their own dead. That's offensive. I'm done with you, Jesus. We don't hear any response. You know why we don't hear any response? It's quite often a tool that Luke uses. There's no response because the story's open-ended and you're meant to insert yourself in the story and say, how do I respond? I want to follow Jesus. Luke assumes everyone that's reading this wants to follow Jesus. So he's inviting us to put ourselves in the story and ask ourselves, how will we respond? Where's Jesus asking us to travel? Not yesterday, but today and tomorrow. And are we ready to follow wherever he goes? Or do we have some conditions attached? Do we have some excuses that we'd like to throw his way? And boy, if let me bury my father isn't valid, then no excuse is. Jesus wants our hearts, not our leftovers. And the reason why he wants our hearts and not our leftovers is the call is to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And Jesus is going to live that out and all along the way to Jerusalem, set his face like flint until he gives everything he could possibly give for the salvation of you and I and even these hothead sons of thunder, James and John. For he longs for us to follow him. Would you pray?